of the terminationists.
Patty Ginsburg, last question before we move on.
Last question. I don't know if you're aware, in Alaska, the shareholders in the regional and village corporations often live in a completely different area from where their corporation is headquartered. On the Menominee Reservation, when you started your re-enrollment, do the members have to live on the reservation? Were there any provisions for people who lived off it?
No, one does not have to live on the reservation to be enrolled as a member of the tribe. You have to have the required blood quantum, which is 1/4.
All right. Well, Mr. Russell Jim, we're looking forward now to hearing from you, sir.
Nech Pachuayal, Tlachwaman, Kuchiskwe, Chiticham, Kunashakanam Shinam Yanawe, Kunam Natchik Shawimin Pripwe, Kushki and I, as Natchik in Miwau Naksash Miwak Ishwit, Kukwayan, Aikdam as Tun Jiao Namwit Doctor.
Justice Berger, fellow colleagues, honored hosts of this land. As dramatic as this may seem to you, I think it should help make a point. In the assimilation process that has been practiced throughout the world against indigenous people, they still do not believe that there is such a thing as biculturalism. I truly believe that biculturalism is a reality, and the indigenous people can develop the possibility of retaining their culture, which is intricately tied to the language and tied to all the resources of the land. I fully appreciate being invited to this forum. And what I said in my language was that on this day, on this land, where the sun now stands as witness to you being here, and here's what we say. Among these honored hosts of these people, of this land, I think needs to be developed an understanding and rid the logic of the uninformed of their mental capacities or mental blocks in regard to the misunderstandings that have been pervaded upon the indigenous peoples of this land. I am a member of the Yakima Indian Nation, and as has been explained, a past tribal councilman. I am a past member of the National Congress of American Indians as an area vice president. I am a past president of the Affiliated Tribes and Northwest Indians. I am a member of the World Council of Indigenous People. I was one of the delegates to Peru in 1979. And I find it extremely satisfying what I have heard here today. And I'm hoping that out of this forum, much misunderstandings will be quelled and quashed. And I also understand that there is a significant contribution by the Alaskan Humanities Department towards this forum. I am also a member of the Washington State Commission for the Humanities. And in that group alone, the minorities, one Spanish, one black, one Indian, has contributed to that humanities project to make it more meaningful and understanding, especially towards the indigenous people of the United States of America. The Yakima Nation, like many tribes throughout the United States, the lower 48, have contributed vast amounts of land, have ceded vast amounts of land to the state of Washington, and felt and still feel that we have paid our taxes for all time. For instance, the Yakima Nation consisted prior to 1855 of 12 million acres in the state of Washington. In the Treaty of 1855, we ceded to the state of Washington 10.8 million acres, and we retained 1.3 million acres. To govern ourselves, to advance ourselves in a manner which befitted our people. That was the understanding, much of it unwritten. But the understanding was fully discussed, and it took weeks and weeks by the people of the Yakima and of the federal government. And there is still the understanding among the people, as long as the sun shall shine, the mountains stand, the rivers flow, and the grass shall grow, that treaty will remain in effect. So the federal government has this fiduciary obligation. But there is either the misunderstanding or the misinterpretation or the blatant disregard of the term trust responsibility. And what is built around this term is a bureaucracy. And I have been on record to call this bureaucracy inept. I have been told by a learned person that worked for us at one time that it seems the bureaucracy is made up of rejects of the corporate world. These people hold your destiny, part of your destiny in their hands. Many times I feel that this is true. And I come away with meetings with the bureaucracy with great dissatisfaction many times. So when I hear for instance, the government-to-government basis that the present administration has promoted, I think it is somewhat insidious. Under this present administration, Indian tribes, for instance, were under the Office of Public Liaison under Morton Blackwell. The Office of Public Liaison is responsible for AFL, CIO, Veterans of Foreign Wars, entities such as that that are non-governmental, and we were under that same committee. In our first meeting of heads of national Indian organizations in Washington, D.C., we quickly advised Mr. Blackwell that he was dealing with the oldest governments on this land. And it is just within the last year or so that we have been moved out of the Office of Public Liaison into a more meaningful committee that deals with governments. But yet much of the long-awaited government-to-government basis and understanding and promotion of rights through the documents, agreements, and treaties have never been fully implemented. Instead, they have been eroded gradually. Perhaps many of you, as I do, feel that education, for instance, is a great thing. I do feel that education is very necessary for all people. But the process implemented upon the indigenous people of this land for the last 60 years has been a travesty and has contributed to the genocide, eventual genocide of a people, by sending them to boarding schools. And I'm sure you've heard the stories of beatings in schools when you spoke your own language, which I have personally witnessed. But I was fortunate to be raised by two aunts that spoke no English. But yet when I was 5 years old, I was sent to one of these boarding schools. They get you away from your everyday teachings of mama and daddy, auntie and uncle, grandma and grandpa. And you are not allowed to listen to your songs and your language on that particular day, that seventh day, which is Sunday. The Yakimas, as many indigenous people are throughout the world, have always known when this sacred day has been. It wasn't taught to us by Christianity. The quote-unquote religion of the Yakimas far exceeds Christianity by thousands and thousands of years. Indigenous people were put on this earth with laws to follow. And we follow those laws and at the same time try to waller through the in excess of 6,000 laws that is implemented upon the indigenous people of the lower 48, created by man on this earth. I would like to continue on and on and on and address just about and elaborate on just about everything I have heard here on this forum so far. And I am somewhat grateful that we have another 3 days to go in case I forget something. But let me try to digress back a little bit from the questions that have arisen here, and I appreciate them very much. The Yakima Nation has been asked to waive its sovereign immunity in dealings, especially economically. When we try to promote, for instance, our own enterprise of road building and tried to economically participate in state road buildings. We had the capacity, we had the people, we had the machinery. And yet, we were asked to waive our sovereign immunity so that we could go off the reservation and help build roads. We refused. We feel that if you allow one little toehold, then you are gradually going to see a foothold and eventual gradual takeover and loss of your sovereignty. Many of you know in this room the protection we have from the Martinez decision and sovereignty, and on the other hand the Oliphant decision that has been handed down, but they seem to balance out for now. But it is evident to me in following nationwide, worldwide happenings, the dilemma under which the indigenous people of this world are under, and each and every administration of the United States of America has contributed in one form or another, another step towards the genocide of a people. No different than there is in the time that I have spoken, approximately 7 acres of forest destroyed somewhere in the world. So I am hoping that this forum and those of you that will one day write books or gather this necessary information and dissect it and see what will come out, I hope that an understanding of the need of the indigenous people to retain their culture and their land and their resources and to remain a unique people. It is very discouraging to me to wonder about my children. What are they going to be faced with when I am gone? And by right, the worry is upon all the elders that are Aborigines to their special lands. The uniqueness that we have, that we retained so far, I think is necessary in all for all humankind to realize. We can't all be alike. But it seems that the main stem of society feels that the assimilation process must come about. Perhaps that is an interpretation of the greed that has been taken place, and especially at a time when the resources of this world are becoming more limited. And the dependency upon the indigenous people, take the Yakima for instance. I have personally chastised the Bureau of Indian Affairs in regard to the harvesting of our timber. On that 1.3 million acres, we have 600,000 acres of timber, some of the best timber in the country. Prime ponderosa pine and the diversity of different types of trees and species. More important is the foods and medicines, the animal habitat, the aesthetics, the environment that is dependent upon that certain stand, a certain type in its own little environment of that timber. And in turn, the indigenous people depend upon culturally for the use of that timber. And no different on the rangelands, which contributes more food and medicines. My forefathers were very wise to pick this piece of real estate out of that 12 million acres. It is very diversified. It goes from sand dunes from the east to mountains on the west. In 1972, with the support of the Alaskan people and other tribes throughout the United States, the Yakimas were returned, Mount Adams, and 21,000 acres that was erroneously filed some 60 years prior. We are still grateful for this, for the support nationwide, and the brotherhood that was pervaded at that time among indigenous peoples. We also incidentally worried a few more people around there. When rumor got out, this year Mont Adams, next year Rainier. No different than the Penobscots, perhaps, and the Passamaquoddies, and especially in this leap year, ladies. This leap year also is a significant an election year, and the theme still is, as Maine goes, so goes the country. So, in the return of the 21,000 acres, it showed somewhat, we thought, good faith. But I think, personally, I think President Nixon was pressured at the time to somewhat get the Indians off his back and sign back the return of the Mount Adams. No different at the time when the Washington 100 people from the state of Washington were allowed to go to Washington, D.C., and meet with the cabinet of the President of the United States, whom was Carter at the time. And that was just about the time my involvement with the World Council of Indigenous People took place. And our lawyer happened to be one of the 100 picked, and he asked Mr. Brzezinski, what is your policy to the indigenous people of this land? At a time when Carter was promoting human rights in Russia. And Mr. Brzezinski had to think a while and say, well, as far as I know, I have to get back to you. As far as I know, we don't have a policy to the indigenous people of this land. I assume you mean the American Indian. He says, yes. He says, I'll have to get back to you. I truly believe also at this time to get the Indians off his back or for some type of good showing, Mr. Carter signed the Native American Freedom of Religion Act. But as you know, it has no teeth without consignment from the legislative body. And as of 2 years ago, we lost 8 major cases so far because it is a toothless tiger to this day. Now, we are confronted with all types of battles, and we can assure lawyers years and years of work. The water issue, for instance, is going to make the fish issue minuscule one of these days. Any water rights the Yakimas have won so far is because the fish were in there. Now, a fish is a cultural portion of the Yakima Indian Nation. In our feasts, as the food was put here on this earth by the Creator, the fish was first, and then the deer, and the roots, and the berries. So it is a very significant portion of our culture. And I'm sure it's a very significant portion of many cultures throughout the world, including Alaska here. So, as I see, as I fear, to win the major water cases in the future, and they have time on their hands, and I say they, the administrations, the mainstem, they have time on their hands, on their side. If they can get rid of the fish for perhaps maybe 10, 15 to 20 years. And no different than in Colombia when they used to shoot the adults and allow the children to roam untaught and would eventually provide the multinational corporations with labor force. Then the children up and coming when the fish is gone would would lose that major portion of their culture. This is perhaps foresight. Perhaps it will never come to be. I hope not. But we have much hindsight also, as was mentioned by Ada. Our past is necessary. And to retain the unique people of this earth, there is much schooling needed to be done by historians. And the textbooks do need to be changed. For instance, there was a ninth grade non-Indian, a white boy, came to me about 6 months ago in the town of Yakima, which is just off our reservation. And his father was a historian and a researcher. But the book, in excess of 25 years old, mentioned the Yakimas in one small paragraph, which also included the Yakima Wars. The Nez Perce, they were mentioned in 3/4 of a page. So there has to be taught in the schools a better history of the indigenous peoples of that respected area, taught to all children. And some of you I saw in Sun Valley, there was a history teacher cornered me there and asked, why am I teaching history of Indians to these kids? Because one day they asked me this, why do we have to learn about these dead Indians? What good is it going to do me? I said to her, the best I can answer you is that in the long run, and I use my son and his neighbor friend as an example. My son is 9 years old. And when they are home from school and they're close by, they are inseparable. They play, they're the same size, they're the same age, they go to the same school. But it's quite a contrast when my son is long braids and his neighbor friend is blonde as can be. But one day, perhaps that blonde little non-Indian will be a mayor or a congressman or a president. And perhaps a certain type of legislation will come down, and this president, if he be, will think back and say, this legislation may affect my friend because I know he has some certain inalienable rights indigenous to his being, his land, and his people. So creating this understanding will lift much of the burden of all of us, I believe. And as I mentioned earlier, I don't believe there is anything worse than the logic of the uninformed. So it's easy to define the things that happen in your own little corner of the world. But I feel, how can I help preserve my people if we do not understand the problems of indigenous people throughout the world? This eventual genocide I speak of here is very subtle. The genocide in Colombia and in Central America is very direct and abrupt. They are promoting perhaps another Vietnam in Central America. And another reason I worry about my son. In 9 years, when he must register, is he going to go down there and fight fellow Indians? We had a mosquito representative in Wisconsin. And their stories were much different than what you read in the papers. In your home newspapers, they're perhaps very uninformed. But they are taken from the AP press, AP polls. I won't get into much of what I have heard and learned from Central America, but I assure you, the annihilation of indigenous people that are Indians in Central America is a reality. And it makes you wonder, and it adds to my paranoia, who is profiting from all of this? The present administration, conservatives, but yet the supporter of multinational corporations that make these weapons, that send your sons and daughters to Lebanon, Grenada, and Central America. The price of a few hundred lives seems to be nothing to create some type of, especially in this recessionary period, some type of support for a multinational corporation. Read the Wall Street Journal and how the World Bank will not lend a corporation any monies to develop in indigenous countries unless they control those people. On a smaller scale here in the United States of America, a federal agency, the Bureau of Reclamation, cannot come on to a Indian reservation and develop a water resource development project, even if it is the most feasible project in the world, unless they control and administer the water. The Yakamini Nation refuses to give up control, administration, and title to its water. So therefore, we don't get a project. The federal government is responsible for erosion of treaties in more ways than one. Take, for instance, the Faustian bargain that science has made with society in the proliferation of nuclear weapons and power. There is enough tailings from uranium mining and waste from nuclear power plants to build a 4-lane highway from coast to coast, 1 foot thick. And these tailings radiate radon, which is deadly eventually. But because of the latency period of 15 to 20 years, nothing ever happens immediately. And so you develop a false sense of security. And at the same time, there is mass deception promoted by the nuclear industries and those that support it. The Yakama Nation got into this foray of nuclear issues in 1979. We were the first tribe to pass a resolution that banned the transportation of nuclear materials across the reservation. At the same time, we were still in the fight, being a 83-80 state. And we said, even though we may be a toothless tiger, if you want confrontation, we will stop you at the borders, those of you that haul nuclear materials. That was the beginning. And now we are involved in the direct confrontation with the NRC and the DOE regarding Hanford, which is just right next to us, and incidentally is inside our ceded area. In that ceded area, we gave to the state of Washington this 10.8 million acres, but yet we retain the right to gather our foods, to hunt and fish in all usual and accustomed places on that ceded area. But with the promotion of the nuclear industry around Hanford and the mishandling of the tailings and the waste, even though it be low-level nuclear waste now, has contaminated much of that land. To the non-Indian, to pick that area, because it, to the non-Indian, he looks out there and he sees, he said, it's wasteland. Sagebrush, rocks. But to an Indian, he looks out there and he sees medicines, foods, berries, birds, animals. Specifically the food that comes out of the ground. And because of its low geographical location, that is where the first foods get ripe. And there is one particular food there that only goes so high in elevation that it stops. And it's a camas type of food that is in danger of, if that becomes fully contaminated, we cannot use the area. We lose this one food, and it's like a vitamin B. You can eat one or two of these, and it gives you much energy. Incidentally, there are 72 different types of foods we have on our reservation. Almost as many types of medicines. There is a medicine for every malady, every sickness. So it has been quite a battle, quite an issue, and seems to have put us in this Alice in Wonderland concept of running faster and faster to stay one place. So I have touched upon just a small portion of the worries, the troubles befronting the indigenous populace of the Yakima and other peoples throughout. And I will reserve now the rest of the time for some questions.
Thank you, Mr. Jim. Rosita Worrell, you have a question.
I don't have a question, but I'd just like to, for the record, indicate that the Yakima people extended a substantial loan to the Alaska Native when they were pursuing their legislative claims in Congress. And after hearing Mr. Jim talk, it's easy to understand that he understood our concern about our land. On a personal note, I would just like to extend our thanks. Alaska Native people would like to thank you and thank the Yakima Nation for their support in our efforts. Gunashtish Yakima Na, Gunashtish Yakima Yatche.
Thank you. I appreciate that very much. My brother, Robert Jim, was chairman at the time. He passed away in 1973, attending another large meeting, and like his father, our father, succumbed to the weight of this problem to protect their people and other Aboriginal people. I spoke with the present chairman of the Yakima Tribal Council just prior to coming up here, whom incidentally is Roger Jim, a cousin. He was just newly elected a week ago yesterday in the reorganization process. And I said, I do not go to speak for the Yakima, but to speak as a representative of the World Council of Indigenous People. And should you want to send someone to speak for the Yakima, it'll be fine. He said, no, you go ahead and you remind them. Remind them and wish them luck in their quest to hope to resolve, or at least preserve and protect for your people in regard to what you do today in regard to ANSCA. He sends his greetings, as does somewhere that were on the council at the time, which is Johnson Maninick, Bill Yallop. They're still on the council. And I appreciate you bringing up that loan that the Yakimas provided to the Alaska Natives, and there's quite a little story behind that. So maybe Don Wright told you some of the story. Thank you.
Back to Mr. Jim. Don Wright, who was president of the Alaska Federation of Natives back in 1971, was here last week, and he did pay tribute to the help received from the Yakima people, as did John Borbridge, Jr., who was here, too. Did you have a question? Mr. Lerner, forgive me.
I was struck by Mr. Jim's account of the anecdote involving Secretary Brzezinski. Two questions growing out of that. You said that your business with the White House was moved from the Office of Liaison to some other office or committee, but you didn't identify what it was. You said it had to deal with governments.
I can't name it right off, and I'll have to
find it. But it wasn't the Department of State, though.
I don't believe so.
Okay. So maybe he was excusable. And the other question was, in speaking about the murderous treatment of Indians in Colombia, I think you mentioned, and Central America, do you also include Nicaragua? I mean, the Indians living on the eastern side there?
Yes, I think you would have to include a lot of Central America. Much of what is going on down there doesn't all get out, as you well know. And so I have, for instance, a little friend here, and he'll be here perhaps next week. He is the interpreter for Jose Carlos Morales, the president of the World Council of Indigenous People, and he's a Guatemalan Indian. And he speaks his Indian language, the Spanish language. When I first met him in 79 in Peru as an interpreter, he could barely speak English. But I last saw him a year ago, January, in Washington. He spoke excellent, better English than I. And he also, he says, now I speak French also. But he said, I cannot go home. He says, they know my work out here now, what I have done, what I have said throughout my dealings in the, around the world. He says, were I to show my face at home, I would be shot on the spot.
Okay. So to that extent, the wholesale killing of Indians is not all done by, to use my favorite Maoist language, running wacky dogs of the multinational corporations.
No, oh. It sure isn't. But it makes you wonder, you know, where does the support come from? We know that the arms that are sold to much of the Central America come from Israel, and Israel gets their arms from the United States of America. So,
and Nicaragua must get it from somewhere too.
Exactly.
Right. Okay. Right. That's really quite tangential to Alaska.
Oh yes.
Yeah, I think we've exhausted that particular aspect of that particular subject, but I think it is right for Mr. Jim to remind us of the condition of indigenous peoples everywhere in this hemisphere. Any other questions for Mr. Jim before we move on? Mr. Naranjo, if you'd like to say something now, you're welcome. And if you complete it before they come bustling in with their bingo cards at 4, well, we'll certainly make you first up tomorrow morning. So,
I think the kinds of things that I have to say with regards to